This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, we consider the national electoral process. We'll be speaking about the rigged presidential debates with George Farah. We'll also be looking at the dark money, the dirty money, the committee money in the presidential campaign funding process as we speak with Thomas Ferguson. Also, voter ID is said to be premised on the existence of so-called voter fraud. There is a study done by Corbin Carson, which finds in 50 states there is virtually none. We'll be speaking with him as well today. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And there will soon be upon us a round of presidential debates, many questions being asked about that, including by George Farah. He is the director of Open Debates, and he now joins us live. And what is it that you are concerned about with the televised presidential debates?
Hi, Robert. Thanks for having me on. Well, the presidential debates are by far the most important political events in our election. It's the only time tens of millions of voters can watch the candidates on the same stage at the same time and actually evaluate them. But the problem is we're not actually getting the kinds of the debates that we deserve, debates that are inclusive, that have challenging formats, and a sufficient number of them. And the reason is the sponsor that controls these critical forums is more focused on pleasing the two parties rather than actually pleasing the voters.
You mean two out of the many parties?
Exactly.
That would be the Commission on Presidential Debates. How do they set up the process?
Well, the commission, it's interesting, just the name, the Commission on Presidential Debates, makes it sound like it's some sort of official government agency. And it's absolutely not. It's a private corporation that was created by the Republican and Democratic parties in 1986. In fact, the parties actually ratified an agreement to, quote, take over the presidential debates. And they seized control of the debates from the League of Women Voters, which was doing an absolutely fabulous job, and have asserted control over it ever since 1988. And what they do is every 4 years they make announcements about when the debates will be held, and they make announcements about their desire to have challenging formats and fair candidate selection criteria. But ultimately, the issues that really govern how the debates will be structured are negotiated by the Republican and Democratic candidates behind closed doors. They get, you know, big powerhouse lawyers and political operatives to meet behind closed doors and hammer out a secret contract. A contract that dictates how the debates will be structured, everything from the temperatures in the auditoriums to who will be asking the questions to, you know, the heights of the podiums. And they hand that contract to the commission, which by and large implements the contracts because, hey, they were created by the two parties and they're not about to antagonize the very candidates they were established to protect.
So it's an owned and operated product of the Republican duopoly.
Exactly. Essentially, the commission has a monopoly on the debates and it allows two parties to control the process with the veneer of nonpartisanship. This is what particularly troubles me. Look, if the Republican Democratic candidates want to host their own debate, this is the United States of America. They can do whatever they want. They can get a gym in some local school. They can host a debate. Every television studio in the country will cover it. But at least they'd be held accountable for those debates. If they excluded a popular third-party candidate, if they avoided difficult questions, or if they opted out not to participate in additional debates, they'd pay the price in the polls. But under this sponsorship regime, the commission is taking the heat. The commission is being blamed for inadequate formats. The commission is being blamed when a Ross Perot-type candidate is not allowed to participate. And that's very convenient for the candidates, but ultimately destructive for our democracy.
So it is a cutout to distract from the conspiracy of the two leading parties. Has there been any attempt to break this system that has now been taken away from the League of Women Voters by other parties? I'm tempted to say third parties, but there are many other parties that are contending. So how do these excludees contest this system?
Oh, it's been an extraordinarily difficult battle for them. The commission will propagate a narrative about third-party candidates that makes it very difficult for anyone to take them seriously. If you ask the commission, hey, why don't you include third-party candidates? Why don't you just let the voters decide who ought to be included in these critical forums? The commission says something like, oh, there are hundreds of third-party candidates, including Billy Joe Clegg of the Clegg Won't Pull Your Leg Party, or Bob Thomas of the Crustacean Liberation Party, and they're going to flood the stage, and we'll be the laughingstock of democracies around the world. This is total nonsense. The reality is never, and never has there ever been in the United States in the last 100 years, more than seven candidates on enough ballots to actually have a mathematical chance of winning the election. And if you allow voters to decide who can participate in the debates, if you say, who do you want in the debates, they by and large choose just a handful. You know, in 1988, they just chose two. In 2000, for example, they chose four: Pat Buchanan, Ralph Nader, Gore and Bush. You know, never have they actually wanted more than four candidates on the stage. So to me, it makes no sense that we have a private commission that arrogantly dictates who ought to participate in these critical forums when the voters themselves are absolutely qualified to make those choices and have yet to demonstrate the sort of recklessness the commission accuses them of.
We're speaking with George Farah of Open Debates, and in your investigations, have you made any headway in seeing a specimen contract for these debates?
Yes, this is what's been very exciting is, you know, these contracts were, well, it's actually worth pointing out, the first contract was negotiated in 1988. That's when the Bush campaign, the Dukakis campaign, put together a 12-page secret contract that dictated how the debates would be structured. And they handed it to the League of Women Voters. And the League said, are you kidding me? We're not going to implement this contract. And they issued a press release making the contract public and lambasting the candidates for hoodwinking the American people. Meanwhile, the Commission on Presidential Debates had just been created, and they gladly stepped in the fray and said, hey, we're happy to implement this very manipulated contract, and that's how they actually seized control of the debates. The contracts that were negotiated in 92 and 96 and 2000 were kept secret. And I got quite lucky, actually. I was interviewing someone for the book that I wrote, No Debate, and he happened to be an inside reporter who got a copy of the contract years ago. He was planning the debates in 92 and 96. He gave me one of the contracts, and we published it for the first time in 2004. And that was the first time anyone in the press, other than a handful of operatives, had seen this contract, which says crazy things like the candidates are not allowed to talk to each other. Follow-up questions are prohibited. All town hall questions must be pre-screened and pre-selected by the moderator. You know, Robert, what kind of debate prohibits the candidates from talking to each other? That's not a real debate. That's more of a glorified bipartisan press conference. We've been unable to get our hands on the 2008 debate contract, and just today we issued a call on the Commission on Presidential Debates to make public this year's debate contract, but no one has a copy of it, and we can't get a hold of it.
Can you take us back into the history of how the operation of these televised performances, how the control of that was wrested from the League of Women Voters?
Sure. You know, what I love is actually comparing the League of Women Voters with the Commission on Presidential Debates. The League is one of the most beloved organizations in the country. It's a champion of democracy. Its only interest is serving the voters. And in 1976, they hosted the first presidential debate since 1960. And they did a good job. And in 1980, John B. Anderson, a former Republican congressman, decided to run as an independent. And Jimmy Carter was president at the time, and he was scared that John Anderson would take votes away from him. Well, Carter refused. President Carter refused to participate in a debate where John B. Anderson would participate. But the League insisted, and the League ended up holding a presidential debate between Republican nominee Ronald Reagan, the independent candidate John B. Anderson, and an empty chair where President Jimmy Carter failed to show up. They were that gutsy. They weren't about to let the President of the United States tell them who could participate in the debate. Fast forward 4 years later, 1984, the Walter Mondale and Ronald Reagan campaigns made a concerted effort to eliminate difficult questions from the presidential debate process. The League proposed a number of journalists that would ask questions during the debate, and the candidates vetoed 80 journalists. 80 of the 83 journalists that the League had proposed, they vetoed. The League said this was crazy. Even though the candidates threatened not to participate in their future debates, they held a press conference and accused the candidates of trying to get rid of difficult questions, attack them for abusing the process. And the candidates were so ashamed and suffering from great criticism in the public press that for the next debate, they happily accepted the League's proposal. So you have this wonderful history, Robert, of the League of Women Voters having the guts to be our advocate. In that negotiating room, there's an organization that's fighting for the voters' interest, and they stood up to make sure candidates were included, and they stood up to make sure the format had some integrity and was challenging. And it's precisely that kind of independence that infuriated the parties. They didn't like the fact that a woman's organization was telling their guys who could participate in these debates and under what conditions. And they formed the Commission on Presidential Debates to resolve this process. And they were the first organization to implement the secret contract. And now the candidates will only participate in commission-sponsored debates. So even if you create a fantastic organization that's going to host the most spectacular debates in the country, the candidates aren't going to show up. They'd obviously much rather be participating in commission debates where they get to control the terms.
What about the so-called moderators? There is, in each cycle, a complaint from one community or another, whether it be women, whether it be African Americans, whether it be Latinos, whether it be Asians, and so on, about debate moderators. And is the selectivity of those who are permitted to host the softball session, is that a part of the system to minimize debate?
There's no doubt in my mind that the candidates have influence over who gets selected. The commission likes to publicly say that they engage in a very intelligent and thoughtful selection process and independently make these choices. Now, we don't have the copy of the contract this year, so it's impossible to verify the actual process. But the negotiations between the candidates started early in the summer, and I have no doubt that they made very specific recommendations to the commission about which journalists could or could not be participants in the process. So to begin with, the candidates exercise at least veto power over who gets to ask questions. And then they selected, you know, far be it from me to criticize the experience of these journalists. They're highly, highly experienced journalists who are very capable of facilitating discussion. But they are absolutely old veterans, and they're all white, and they are not exactly going to pose surprising questions. This is the 12th time that Jim Lehrer is going to host a presidential debate. If I'm a candidate, I just watch the transcripts or watch the video footage of the 11 times that Jim Lehrer has hosted these debates, and you can pretty much predict what kind of questions he's going to ask and why. And it's not a coincidence that Jim Lehrer has been asked over and over and over again to host these debates. He really doesn't shock the candidates. He doesn't challenge them that aggressively. He's likely to comply with the rules very comfortably. You know, you're not going to see, someone, who, like Tim Russert, he's no longer with us, but he was an aggressive mainstream journalist, but at least he was willing to challenge the guests he had on television. He's the kind of guy the commission, the candidates will not let sponsor or host a debate.
Speaking of the elephant in the room, the television system is a commercial-based operation, and certainly there is an interest in formulating the kind of mood, the kind of questions, the kind of script that is compatible with the sponsors that usually work with such a station or network. Have you looked at the financial incentive for the debates to be compatible with the marketing base of the broadcaster?
That's a great question. It's difficult to argue there's any sort of quid pro quo, but there's undoubtedly an ugly financial influence over these processes. I don't think, because Anheuser-Busch, for example, is financing the Commission on Presidential Debates as one of its major national sponsors, that it means the moderator has been instructed not to ask questions about beer. But I do think there's a couple very, very ugly financial associations with the commission that remind us this is not an entity that is operating in the best interest of our democracy. To begin with, the commission itself gets an extraordinary amount of money from large corporations. Anheuser-Busch, the Bottled Water Association, HP, Continental Airlines, Philip Morris, these have all previously been major national sponsor of the commission and donate hundreds of thousands of dollars and millions of dollars to the commission to host these debates. Second of all, when the league used to host these debates, they would go to civic groups, businesses, and say, hey, we would love to raise some money to put on these debates. And the president of the league, Nancy Newman, told me they'd be lucky to get a $5,000 check. But the commission is able to raise vast sums of money. Why? Well, as one of the operatives for one of these companies told me, they kind of see it as a soft money donation. By giving hundreds of thousands of dollars to the commission, which was created by the two parties, they're kind of hitting two birds with one stone. They're able to give to two campaigns, two parties, without having to worry about limits on their contributions. So it's very attractive for them. And then while the league had audience members full of civic leaders, the heads of the NAACP and ACLU were in the audience, if you go to a commission-sponsored debate, the audience is full of the executives of Anheuser-Busch, and you've got scantily clad Bush girls passing out pamphlets to reporters denouncing beer taxes. And lastly, on this issue, it's fascinating to take a look at the two co-chairs of the commission. One of the co-chairs is Frank Fahrenkopf. He's run the commission since its inception. He's the former head of the Republican Party, and he's the nation's leading gambling lobbyist. He's the head of the American Gaming Association. And the other co-chair is Mike McCurry. He was the press secretary to President Bill Clinton, and he's a partner at Patton Boggs, a lobbyist firm in Washington, D.C. In other words, the two guys running these debates are not only extraordinarily loyal to the two parties that they used to work for, but they're also lobbyists who, in their careers, have not exactly demonstrated a commitment to putting voters' interest above political process interest or moneyed interest.
Our guest is George Farah of Open Debates. The website for them is at opendebates.org. And is there any remedy that you have encountered for people to get a more fully informed spectrum of candidacies?
Yeah, you know, it's a very tough nut to crack. First of all, I'd strongly encourage your listeners to check out our website, opendebates.org. It has this information, and you can sign up for action alerts, and we try to put pressure. The good news is, ultimately, these are our candidates. So when this issue grows in significance, and when more and more people become informed about this issue, it's going to be politically expensive for the candidates to only participate in commission-sponsored debates. In other words, you know, if we can make available to the candidates two kinds of debates, there's the debates offered by the Commission on Presidential Debates, and there are debates offered by an alternate organization that truly represents the interest of voters, you know, as a cross-section of the civic community, a kind of League of Women Voters and modern version of it. And the candidates only participate in the commission's debates, and they get flack for it. Eventually, it's going to be so costly that they're going to have to participate in a more genuine and transparent and challenging and inclusive debate. That's my vision. I know this is a marathon and not a short-term sprint, and election cycle after election cycle, we're raising this issue. It's getting more and more understood by the press and millions of voters around the country. Doesn't matter where you are on the political spectrum, conservative, liberal, centrist, this issue tugs at your heartstrings because it's our debates, and we're being kind of deceived about who's controlling them, and it's directly affecting our most sacred public forums. So in my opinion, Robert, it's a matter of time before the commission gets displaced because everyone becomes aware of just how destructive they can be.
George, we've been speaking about the presidential, the executive branch elections, but do you see a similar process of ideological containment taking place in the legislative branch with the Senate and House election system?
You know, it's a great question. When it's focused specifically on debates, what happens is the commission kind of sets the gold standard across the country. And whether you have a local candidate running for mayor or running for Congress or running for governor, you have various organizations, the local chapter of the League of Women Voters, a television station, some sort of academic institution that wants to host a local debate. And they're trying to figure out, well, what kind of candidate selection criteria do we use? And they look to the commission. So the commission is the role model, unfortunately, for dozens and if not hundreds of potential debate sponsors around the country who unwittingly adopt a candidate selection criteria that is very exclusionary. You know, the commission has this rule. You need to get 15% in the polls in order to have a chance to participate in their debates. There's a number of reasons that's ridiculous. The most important, I think, is if you get 5% in the polls, Congress gives you millions of dollars in matching funds. In other words, if I run for president and I get 5% of the vote, the next time I want to run for president, I have tens of millions of dollars of taxpayer funds. Well, that's a little ridiculous. If I have tens of millions of dollars in taxpayer funds for getting 5% in the polls, why do I need three times that amount to have a chance to even say something on the presidential debate screen? And so what you're seeing across the country is independent candidates, refreshing, thoughtful candidates, being shut out of local debates for Congress, for Senate, for governor, around the country, because the debate sponsors are just looking at the commission to set the standard. And as a result, of course, you mentioned the phrase ideological containment. As a result, we're having a narrower and narrower band of issues affect our political discourse and what's being legislated about in Congress.
Well, I'd like to thank you for breaking the veil with a great deal of insight about the presidential debate system. And we've been speaking with George Farah of opendebates.org. And please continue the good work, and we'll speak again before the election cycle is done.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you for having me on.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we'll continue with more Dirty Politics and Dark Money.
You tried to buy a congressman lately? Man, I saw mine on eBay going for $1.5 million. It takes a dead president or two to purchase my favorite brew. But if Bud is free speech the way I hear, then bartender, where's my free beer? As both stand and sucker can see, the system's corrupt as can be. Democracy ain't diddly squat, when government has to be bought. When money talks, it rides on limo wheels. A chump change walks on rundown hills. When you suckers think that someone hears you shout, an avalanche of money drowns you out. Presidential pictures in green, they all stuffed into the money machine. Means only dead presidents vote, it's true. And they don't vote for me and you. Flows. Money, 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 you know where it goes. Money for the congressman, bags and bags of dough. Money for the senator for quid pro quo. Let's repeal hypocrisy when you hear them gloat. They chump unless you're filthy rich, we don't hear your vote. So welcome to the team and ranks of voters second class. Unless you feed the greed machine and kicks your sorry ass. Presidential pictures in green, they all stuffed into the money machine. And beans only dead presidents vote, it's true. And they don't vote for me and you. Well, only dead presidents vote to get a clue. And they don't vote for ragged chumps like you.
Only Dead Presidents Vote, performed by Bob Malone. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and the phrase dead presidents is something of an oxymoron because only the deceased are allowed by federal law to be placed on United States currency. However, those faces are often hidden in the electoral process. And we're now joined live by Thomas Ferguson, who has been looking into the dark money, the hidden processes of big funding of electoral campaigns. Welcome to 5 O'Clock Shadow.
Hi there.
Well, what is this concept of dark money?
Well, okay, it's used in a lot of ways, not always consistently. But what I'd say is the true dark money, really dark, is the stuff spent by groups that don't have to file anything at all with the Federal Election Commission or with the IRS, which are the two places, depending on what you're doing, you file something. And these are mostly people who pretend to be charities. This we could immediately go wonky and have everybody trapped in their car at 5 o'clock go feeling into the shadows for good. They're 501c4s is what most of these folks, not everybody is. It takes its name from the IRS code that they have to sort of register under. And these are people who basically claim to be doing charitable or some kind of other public thing, are actually putting money into elections. And since they're charitable groups, our FEC, which has, you know, just doesn't regulate. I mean, these guys make the SEC and the Federal Reserve in the years before 2008 look like eager beavers. They've let them get away with basically not filing anything. And so the real dark money is that stuff. And what you're finding now, everybody sort of heard of super PACs, which are these allegedly independent things, independent of the candidates, though it is now ridiculous and obvious that they aren't. These super PACs do at least most of them register and spend and account for where the cash come from. But the dodge that many are now doing is they have sort of like a double star. There's the super PAC that you can see, and then the dark body circling around it is the 501c4 charitable group. And so the charitable group collects a lot of cash on top of what the super PAC is collecting. Then it hands the money in one big hunk to the filing super PAC. And then the beauty of that scheme is you see only the transaction from the dark star to the public star, and you don't know where the money came from. It's spectacular. It's also ridiculous. I mean, we're now going 1-2 with Guatemala and Nicaragua in the bad old days. We're making banana republics look good with operations like this.
Well, one should seldom confuse elections with democracy.
That's a position I've sort of carefully maintained and developed over the years. I am virtually alone in political science in doing that, but yes, you get it. Yeah.
Well, there is a recent controversy in Congress over the allowing of $10,000 donations to be made and not disclosed. Can you tell us what happened there?
Well, I think you're referring to that suggestion. It was a bill the Democrats put up to require 501c4s and similar groups to file. They had a $10,000 limit on it. I didn't like that. I thought that was insane. That's sort of a wonderful study in what party competition boils down to these days. That is to say, on the one side, you have the Republicans who wanted nothing, and then you have the Democrats telling people, we'll regulate it if it's $10,000 or more. Well, look, I will tell you, and my colleague Paul Jorgensen and Ji Chen and I have been working on this now for quite some time, we're watching and sorting through like 2008. People have caught on. We're not the first there to notice that the Obama campaign in 2008 told a lot of people to write small checks so that it looked like it was a lot of small donors. Now, people figured out that eventually, some year or two after the election, a lot of folks did notice. But we're sort of doing a systematic survey of this, and we find it's quite enormous. We'll pretty soon have big totals, but we're talking really large sums. This campaigns do this, and if you put a $10,000 limit on it, you can be sure that people are going to be rolling $9,000 contributions in there. I thought it was crazy. That's where we're at these days. Democrats versus Republicans, $10,000 limit versus no limit. I mean, that's what that was about. It was defeated.
The Federal Elections Commission and the organization Open Secrets maintains access to a database of donors. And we often see, looking at that, patterns of repeated donations from a particular family household address or corporate organization. The ability to at least have that incomplete level of review of campaign money, is that under any possible jeopardy with proposals to limit access to that information?
Well, now, Kara, the stuff that you have no access to is the so-called dark money. And for sure, you can't get at that. I have trouble with the existing tabulations. I know those are well off because my colleagues and I, we actually are rerunning the entirety of the Federal Election Commission money. We're not using, in other words, Open Secrets, which I think does a good job in general. But I am certain that they underestimate the amount of sort of combined give. The problem being a lot of people have multiple addresses and things like this. And they also spell their names differently. It's really a problem in database management, and my colleagues and I have attacked that with, I think, probably the best computer programs that are around right now. And we're seeing substantially larger concentrations than anybody else has recorded. We haven't written this up yet, but we soon will. But I will tell you right now, I know that the estimates that you see are too low. Look, this whole thing is crazy. It's become madness. Anytime you've got large sums of money that are not recorded, you are asking for trouble. And I would add this, even so right now, folks, when I last looked, they have about 34 million that people were able to track thus far in 2012 from dark money. You do that, the way you track them is you look up the likely donors on an income tax form that they have to file to, and you hope that you can get some disclosure. And the center's done a good job on that, Center for Responsive Politics, that does open secrets. But there, but you know, we'll see a lot more of this, and we're going to be late with it in the sense that in this it's like watching light from a star that, you know, is 40 light years away. You're seeing stuff that was 40 years ago when the light hits you. It's not quite that bad, but it's 6 to 9 months out of date, and you don't get it all. If you give people loopholes, they'll take them. And to sort of make a big, this, it's one thing in presidential races where, you know, 30, 40, or 100, even 200 million, somebody might say, you know, that's maybe a fifth of one candidate's spending or something like that. You start talking congressional races, and especially House races, and you show up in one of those with, say, $5 or $10 million outside, and you have got, that's like detonating a nuclear bomb in the middle of, you know, a quiet Sunday morning in a small New England town or something. You've got to sort of pay attention and use some imagination on sort of where the cash goes. And in local races where these guys, God knows what's going on there, the states don't seriously regulate that stuff. I see where the Attorney General of New York is talking about asking some of the folks that are spending in New York to sort of come in with better disclosure. I actually don't understand why all the attorney generals don't try that under their state laws. Another thing tells me I do, and that's they're all getting contributions for reelections too. But we are looking at a travesty. I mean, this has become crazy.
This is quite a revelation. We're speaking with Thomas Ferguson. He's at UMass at Boston and is also a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. And Thomas, to help people get a better sense of these things, where can they follow your work and how do you recommend that people can be protected about big money?
Look, I have to tell you, you're not going to save the world by following anybody's work, my own included. But if you want to do that, you know, most of my short pieces come out on Alternet, where I'm contributing editor. So if you just go into Google and type Thomas Ferguson Alternet, they all come up. There are actually a fair amount of them, including three recent pieces on the Federal Election Commission, which turned out to have many more data problems. Just, I mean, they were deleting contributions, weren't owning up to it, and that was insane. I mean, the whole system here, even the reporting system, is much more problematic than, you know, if you'd asked me a year ago, and I've spent like 25 or 30 years in this, I would have said, well, I thought we could rely on the FEC. I now know better for what, I mean, the FEC only partly covers it, but, you know, so you go, basically to answer your question, you go Alternet. But look, this is not a problem you can fix by reading somebody's work. This needs real action.
Well, thank you for being a part of that action. Part of the action is education, and we thank you for presenting us with that today.
Sure, thanks. I'll be happy to go right back into the shadows here for the evening. Okay.
Well, this is indeed 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And coming up, we'll be investigating whether the voter fraud debate is itself fraudulent.
When November is here, a national election is drawing very near. Put up bumper stickers, posters, and signs for your candidates, it's voting time. Every other year, when November is here, a national election is drawing very near. We will get to pick who our leaders will be.
Aren't you glad we have democracy? Hey. Every other year in November there's election day. Everyone will hear loud and clear what the people say. We live in a land that was founded on democracy. This was an idea from the ancient Greek philosophy. Voting can help people bring about what they want to see. They can pick the leaders that they think will act responsibly. Used to be that voting only was for those with property. Then only for white men, there wasn't much equality.
Through history, initially our country did begin refusing voters who were African American. But voting shouldn't focus on the color of your skin. So 1817 brought the first correction. It came in the form of the 15th Amendment. The proud for years had to fight and defend it. Some states found ways to keep prejudice alive until the Civil Rights Act, 1965.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York and honored to be joined live now by Corbin Carson. He is a senior in the master's program at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism, also doing work with News 21 in Arizona, and he is the team leader of an investigation that spanned all 50 states about the extent of the existence of so-called voter fraud in the United States. First of all, welcome to the Shadow, Corbin.
Robin, thank you for having me.
Well, what did you find?
Well, as you said, we investigated the entire country since 2000, and after sending out public records requests to each of the 50 departments of elections, secretaries of state, District of Columbia Board of Elections, U.S. Department of Justice, FBI, etc., what was returned was 2,068 alleged election fraud cases since 2000. Now, the interesting thing is the only type of case that can be stopped by the 37 state legislatures that are trying to enact tougher voter ID laws is voter impersonation. And we only found in the last 12 years 10 cases of that, which represents one out of about every 15 million prospective voters.
But yet this is such a loud debate about voter fraud, and it is used as one of the bully pulpits in regard to changing legislation. The prospect of voter ID and such is very much on the horizon, but it is startling, the very small degree that you found looking through 50 states. What are your reflections on that?
Well, you know, from speaking to experts, we've been doing this for about 8 months, from speaking to experts about the election process, what we're hearing is that in-person voter impersonation fraud, it's rare. I mean, our data shows that about 207 cases of other types of fraud for every one case of voter impersonation, and I think that needs to be made clear.
What is voter impersonation?
That would be, and here's the distinction we drew. Of the cases that we received, we found out that there are campaign officials that are doing this. There are election officials that are doing this. Those are people involved in the election process. There are third-party organizations like your Acorns that are doing this. But the voters makes up, according to our data, roughly one-third of all the cases reported. And a voter would be me and you, an average person going into a poll or casting an absentee ballot. But for voter impersonation, that would be one person going into a poll and pretending to be somebody else.
Corbin, you know, over recent years, there's been a dramatic change in the voting process in many districts across the country with the advent and implementation of electronic voting systems. And did you find any impact of this new technology as opposed to the old neighborhood base with a pull the lever voting machine? Does the new technology have any input into the measurement of electoral fraud?
Not any direct input that we could find definitively by the data. We did find that there is more fraud in absentee ballots and voter registration than any other categories. So you're having most of the fraud happen before it even gets to a counting official or to the actual counting day, the day of.
Well, that's very interesting. The armed forces are certainly a large contingent of the total absentee ballots across the country, I would imagine. How does one defraud through the use of an absentee ballot?
Well, this first of all, of the 2,068 alleged election fraud cases, it needs to be made clear that a lot of these are just mistakes. I don't want to say just mistakes, but a lot of them are mistakes. So voters make mistakes. Election officials make mistakes. So actually having the intent to defraud or having intent to change the outcome of an election, that was even rarer. So what we're seeing is how can someone, you were asking, how can someone defraud with an absentee ballot? This is a situation to where, I mean, maybe a wife would sign the absentee ballot for her husband, or vice versa, or something of that nature.
Tell us about the team that you were involved with through the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and the News 21 team. How did you begin and complete this investigation?
Well, the News 21 team is a collection. It's funded by the Carnegie Knight Foundation and Knight Foundations. It's a collection of journalism students from across the nation. Multiple schools were involved, and they select the top students. And of those, you have to attend a seminar where we do all of our background research for the first few months. And then each year they select a topic, which is rare in the media. As you know, you normally have a day turnaround. We got to spend almost a year on this. And this year it was voting rights. And I was selected to do to be in charge of the voting fraud team. And we decided is we wanted to shed some light on the national debate. It's such a hot political topic, and we thought helping add the data to the topic would help the national discussion.
How can people learn more? What is your next project?
Well, answering the first, how can people learn more? We have the site is at votingrights.news21.com, and I encourage your listeners to go play with the data. I mean, I use the word play because it's an interactive database, meaning you can look in your area, see what type of fraud, what type of person committed it, and additionally, you can see all the records we looked at. We reviewed over 5,000 documents, so you would be able to see any email contact we had with state officials. It's online. If they told us it wasn't their job to give us the public records, it's online. Any cases that were given to us are online. It's all for the public to go through.
Well, I'd like to congratulate you and your colleagues on a very important piece of work, and I commend our listeners' attention to your work at news21.com or votingrights.news21.com. And what are you planning to do next?
Well, right now I'm getting ready to graduate here in December and hopefully enter the exciting field of journalism.
Well, you've already done so, and in a very fine way. Thank you for being with us today, Corbin Carson.
Thank you for having me.
All right, this is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, and we conclude with a reflection under the retrenchment of voting rights that is taking place in Congress and around the country and in localities with the imposition of voter ID requirements where they had not existed before. And we consider the origin of this reactionary movement in the United States by looking back at the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Here now, President Lyndon Baines Johnson addressing that very subject on the Ides of March in the year 1965.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, members of the Congress, I speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy. I urge every member of both parties, Americans of all religions and of all colors, from every section of this country, to join me in that cause. At times, history and fate meet at a single time, in a single place, to shape a turning point in man's unending search for freedom. So it was at Lexington and Concord. So it was a century ago at Appomattox. So it was last week in Selma, Alabama. There, long-suffering men and women peacefully protested the denial of their rights as Americans. Many were brutally assaulted. One good man, a man of God, was killed. There is no cause for pride in what has happened in Selma. There is no cause for self-satisfaction in the long denial of equal rights of millions of Americans. But there is cause for hope and for faith in our democracy and what is happening here tonight. For the cries of pain and the hymns and protests of oppressed people have summoned into convocation all the majesty of this great government, the government of the greatest nation on earth. Our mission is at once the oldest and the most basic of this country: to right wrong, to do justice, to serve man. In our time, we have come to live with the moments of great crisis. Our lives have been marked with debate about great issues, issues of war and peace, issues of prosperity and depression. But rarely in any time does an issue lay bare the secret heart of America itself. Rarely are we met with a challenge not to our growth or abundance or our welfare or our security, but rather to the values and the purposes and the meaning of our beloved nation. The issue of equal rights for American Negroes is such an issue. And should we defeat every enemy, and should we double our wealth and conquer the stars and still be unequal to this issue, then we will have failed as a people and as a nation. For with a country as with a person, what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? There is no Negro problem. There is no Southern problem. There is no Northern problem. There is only an American problem.
President Lyndon Baines Johnson addressing a joint session of Congress on the 15th of March, 1965, speaking in reference to the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And we thank our guests today, Corbin Carson of VotingRights.News.21, also Thomas Ferguson from the Roosevelt Institute about dirty money in political elections, and George Farah of Open Debates. And we thank our engineer, Joyce Jones, and our producer, Thiago Ferroso, for the program today. And we invite your comments, tips, leaks, and questions and suggestions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And 4 or 5 o'clock shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.